Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
Domino's listened to our harshest critics and recently introduced our best pizza ever.
Get a large one-topping pizza free when you purchase a large pizza. Order now at PapaJohns.com.
Let yourself go to Pizza Hut. Let yourself go to Pizza Hut.
Little Caesars created the new bacon-wrapped deep dish pizza topped with pepperoni and bacon and wrapped in over 3.5 feet of bacon.
Don't settle for unflavored crust. Make the right call with Pizza Hut.
That crust is incomplete.
Pizza, pizza.
Pizza, no question. We love it so much so that on any given day, 40 million Americans are eating it, and that may be thanks to the powerful pizza lobby. We're going to talk more about pizza's proponents in D.C. and how they're fighting healthy food advocates later on in the show. But first, elsewhere in the nation's capital, it was quite a morning at the Supreme Court. Impassioned arguments were made either to save or scrap a key portion of the Affordable Care Act. In essence, the justices will decide whether to get rid of a provision that now gives around 8 million people subsidies for their health insurance. Dahlia Lithwick covers the law and courts for Slate, and she was at the court this morning. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Madeline.
Well, first, let's get a quick recap from you on what this case is about. Essentially, it challenges the Affordable Care Act on a very narrow legal argument, just four words, but it could have really big implications.
That's right. This is not the Commerce Clause from 3 years ago when we heard the court arguing in Sebelius. This mm-hmm. is four little words and how to interpret a statute, and the four little words packed in this 900-page statute that seem to imply that in the states that chose not to create their own state exchanges, so there were 17 states that created their own state exchanges, 34 states didn't want to create exchanges, and so their citizens buy their insurance on healthcare.gov, the federally run exchange. And the language in the law suggests that only people who are in state-created exchanges are eligible for the tax subsidies that are the cornerstone of this law. And the language certainly says exchanges created by the states. It certainly seems to imply, if you read it completely out of context, that all those folks in the 34 states, as you said, that's 8 million people, might lose their tax subsidies because their states didn't create their own exchanges and they are not eligible for tax benefits.
So was that the thrust of the argument, whether or not it should be read in context or read separately, that one phrase?
That was a big part of it, although both sides clearly and plainly argued that their reading, whether you read only those four words or out of context, in context, that their reading was the manifestly only way to read the statute. But the other thing that did go on that was interesting was arguments that have been raised not in the actual briefs in the case, but in the supplemental briefs that make what is called a federalism or states' rights argument, that say it's not fair to those states who signed up on the federal exchange to give them all these benefits for a couple of years and then yank them away, that that's unduly coercive and it puts the states at a disadvantage, especially if you don't alert the states in the text of the statute that that's coming. And interestingly, Madeline, Justice Anthony Kennedy, often seen as the swing voter at the court, was very, very receptive to the argument that if you read the case where these four plaintiffs read it, then you're really putting the states at this terrible disadvantage with respect to the federal government. And he called that a serious constitutional concern. One never wants to read too much into what any one justice says at one argument, but it did signal, I think, to some watchers that he was worried about the argument that the plaintiffs were making.
Now, what about the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who supported the law a few years ago? Where was he leaning? Could you tell?
Well, that was the question. Everybody said, you know, he defected and voted with the Liberals last time. Where's his head this time? And I have to tell you, he was almost completely silent. Neither side, I think, could say that they could score any sense of what the Chief Justice was thinking. He kind of ran the show, made sure everyone had a little extra time to speak, told his colleagues to be quiet when they got too rambunctious, but never at any point signaled which way he was leaning. And I think that for the people who say, well, you know, what does it mean that he sided with the Liberals last time and upheld the law? I think that they're going to just have to wait and see how this plays out, because nothing in his questioning today signaled one way or the other.
Now, yesterday on the show, we talked about standing and whether or not the four plaintiffs in the case have standing to actually bring this. Was that brought up at all today?
You know, it's interesting. Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, brought it up right out the gate. Michael Carvin, who was arguing for the four petitioners in this case, couldn't even open his argument before she started saying, hey, I think not all your folks have standing. It was an interesting situation because Michael Carvin insisted that at least one of the plaintiffs had standing, and you only need one to have standing to proceed. Don Verrilli, the Solicitor General, more or less said, look, this is an interesting issue. If the court wants to look into it, the court should look into it. But if Michael Carvin says one guy has standing, maybe that's enough. So he didn't really grab that as a toehold in the case. The court does have an independent duty and obligation to figure out if the plaintiffs have standing. But I have to say that watching both sides say, eh, there's probably standing, it's hard to see that the court is going to turn the whole case on that issue.
And is that because the government, at least on Verrilli's side, the government thinks that they have a strong case and they don't need to argue the standing issue, that they just want to get this case through so that they have a substantive ruling on the health care law?
Boy, it sure looked like that was the takeaway, Madeline. It seemed that at every turn when the government could have seized, whether it was that states' rights argument that was bothering Kennedy, whether it was the standing argument, whether there's this other argument that's called Chevron deference, where you're supposed to defer to the agency tasked with interpreting a law. And when he was asked about each of those kind of winning arguments, he was like, eh, maybe, you know, I don't know. But really, on the plain meaning of the statute, we win anyway. So it's an interesting strategy. That was the strategy we saw in the briefs, where he just really wanted to talk about the text and the plain meaning of these words in the law and all this other ancillary stuff that's been, you know, hopping up the blogosphere. Not that interesting to him today.
Well, what in terms of the effect was interesting to the justices? Did they seem to take into account what the effect would be on these 8 million or so people who would lose their subsidies if this part of the law was invalidated?
Almost not at all. It was fascinating that for those of us who've been thinking about this case in terms of millions of people losing health care, people who have health care not having access to, you know, critical life-saving health care, almost not at all did it come up. To the extent that it came up when two of the more conservative justices, Antonin Scalia and Samuel Alito, suggested that, oh, look, if all these catastrophic things happen that the government warns of, then either Congress can just fix a statute and that elicited great laughter, or the states can just go ahead and create their own exchanges, which also elicited laughter. But I think there was a sense that, oh, if you're going to say, you know, be doomsayers and say all these terrible things can happen, understand that Congress or the states will fix it. And so it seemed to be that to the extent that it was brought up at all, it was brought up by folks who were sympathetic to the claims of the petitioners and who really wanted to make the point that that's been overblown.
Hmm. All right. So we're expecting a decision sometime before June, before late June. Are there any legal challenges in the works to this law?
No, this is the one I think that really got legs. I think most of the challenges that were all sort of filed in a rush around the time that Obamacare was enacted, so many of them have disappeared. This is one that I think I could even say surprising many people not only had legs, but really prevailed in lower appeals courts. And I think this is the one that folks are watching and really trying to look deeply at, you know, if the court has a second bite at this issue, are they going to come out differently than they did in 2012?
Dahlia Lithwick covers the law and courts for Slate. Thank you very much, Dahlia.
My pleasure, Madeline.
Well, there was an election here in Los Angeles yesterday, though you might not have known it from the sounds of silence at many polling places throughout the city. About 10% of registered LA voters turned out. So out of the 1.8 million people who could have voted yesterday, who were registered, only about 180,000 people actually bothered to do so. But let's pretend people care and go over the results with Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and vice president of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission.
I am bringing you into a fantasy land of people caring. Allow me to guide you through the what was this morning about 8% turnout and what I think will bump up once everything is counted to about 10%. One in 10 people.
And so how bad is that in terms of turnout, in historic turnout?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, let's do group therapy bad. I mean, it is bad. It's embarrassing. So 1 in 10 people who bother to register, and there are a lot of people who are eligible to register who don't. So, you know, what we have in some races is about 5,000 people deciding who their city council person is going to be. Now, it's important to remember that in LA, we have huge city council districts, about 250,000 people in a city council district. I mean, these are astonishingly low numbers. We absolutely cede our power to this voting class. And the real problem is that they don't even represent us. It's not like, oh, well, here's your young person and here's your Hispanic person. It's not. The people who show up, and I was one of them, you know, it was me and the mouse in my pocket when I went to my polling place. And they thanked me so profusely that I, you know, almost wanted to keep
voting.
Well,
maybe if they gave you more than just a sticker, maybe that would get people to turnout.
Well, there was a lottery idea that was floated a while ago, but instead we're just going to consolidate our elections. But, you know, the people who show up, we're older, we're whiter, we're better educated, we're wealthier. So none of us need to wonder why maybe we talk about pension reform more than we talk about student loan debt. Or, you know, we talk about the issues that affect those who vote, and that's only normal, but it's just not a representative group at all.
So I guess you do this on the Ethics Commission and, you know, wearing your hat as a law school professor, and a lot of people are worrying about how to change this, how to make it more representative, how to get people excited. One way, I guess, is by consolidating the elections, which is what happened in the vote yesterday, right?
So we voted yesterday. We had two ballot measures. And, you know, frankly, I don't think this helped turn out any. Am I excited about ballot measures that talk about consolidating elections? Yes, I am. But I'm an election law professor. So if they weren't going to get me, they weren't going to get anyone. Right. So a charter amendments 1 and 2, which passed by wide margins, would consolidate elections. So you and I aren't going to have this conversation about odd year elections after 2017. So it will kick in 2020 and 2022 so that city elections are linked up when we vote for state and federal offices. So we'll only vote in June and November. And the idea is that more people come out when we're voting for president or when we're voting for governor. And then we'll get all those people. They'll just keep going down the ballot. Now, critics say, yeah, but they're going to have to go really far down below even judges. And so will they drop off? You know, the hope, and there's a political science that bears this out, indicates that once you decide to show up, you actually will endeavor to educate yourself.
Well, other cities do it that way. Other places do it that way. And it seems to work at least a little better than it works here in terms of turnout.
Yeah. Again, we have, you know, congratulations. We've set an extremely low bar. But yes, I think it would work better.
But then it's strange because not all of them are aligned. The city council races are now aligned with presidential elections and not the other citywide races.
Right. We would still vote kind of half and half. So for half of our city and LAUSD and community college, we would vote in presidential years. For the other half, we would vote in gubernatorial years. So we would still be split up, but we would eliminate a lot of these elections, which, you know, are there drawbacks to this? Absolutely. It means that city candidates will have to compete for voters' attention when we're talking about who's going to be the leader of the free world. And that means that, you know, maybe a few independent expenditures here and there will be really important for these city council candidates. The idea then being they'll be very susceptible to outside influence. So, you know, I guess I'm throwing a lot of rain down on this, but there is no perfect proposal. I think consolidation is one of the things we talk about when we talk about increasing voter turnout.
What's another thing?
So, you know, other issues we talk about are, should we even require, you know, step one is we require people to register. Should we require registration at all? Should you just be automatically registered? Step two, how you vote. So one, we should have voting centers, voting places where you can go for 2 weeks and just drop by and, oh, that's right, I should vote. Not this like, oh, my God, it's Tuesday. Is it election day?
Well, that's what mail-in ballots are for. You could mail in your ballot anytime, right?
You could mail in your ballot anytime, but we're not.
Three people? And so, but I think, you know, it just comes down to whether or not people feel connected and whether or not they think it's important for them to vote. I mean, people
and they don't
care because they don't see city government actually doing anything that matters for them.
Well, right. And I think, you know, the biggest change would be if I could pick up my phone and vote that way. Because the truth is, you know, for my students, the mail is this thing that their parents do where they have their mailboxes. And
so you
there
could
are
text
these foreign
in your vote,
options.
Maybe.
Yeah. So if we could text, I think that would change things. But you're right. I mean, look, LA is not a political town and we feel disconnected. So we feel like we can't change the outcome. We now know that you actually could if you showed up. But then a lot of people don't care who wins for school board, who wins for community college. There are a lot of people who don't care about the charter amendments. And it's very difficult to explain to people. It's exactly what you said. How do your elected officials change your daily life? Why is your life different because this person is controller or city attorney? And it's hard to make the case that it's important to weigh in even if it doesn't affect what mm-hmm. happens at your dinner table.
Right, right. Okay, so given all that, let's just set that aside. And looking at what happened yesterday, mainly the incumbents, was there any race there that kind of stood out for you as unusual or interesting or in any way would usher in some kind of important broad change that would affect a lot of people?
Well, so I think in terms of change, that's not what we're going to see right now, because as you said, the incumbents won. So I think the only runoff will be Council District 4, which was an open seat because Tom LaBonge was termed out. And there were, you know, everybody and their cousin ran. Well, there were 14 candidates. And so what separated, you know, the first candidate from the fifth candidate, I think, was about 900 votes. So I don't think that this is going to be an era of change because we saw that incumbents won. You know, one of the things that's interesting is to look to how much money did the candidates spend. And in this race, the open race, Council District 4, we have Carolyn Ramsey spending about $140 per vote. She got 2,900 votes. We have David Rue, the second, it looks like the runner-up, spending about $145 per vote. And interestingly, the top two vote getters were the top two spenders. And, you know, that's certainly what we saw in the other races. Mm-hmm. Not going to surprise anyone either, is incumbents can raise and spend more money and incumbents win. You know, we saw this in Council District 2, 6, 10 and 14.
One of the school board races, I think, is particularly interesting. And that was the seat that is occupied currently by Bennett Kaiser. And he's facing a really tough runoff by Ref Rodriguez. Bennett Kaiser, a big union supporter. Ref Rodriguez, a big charter school supporter. And so I'm wondering if that's going to be a referendum on the direction the school board will take in general and, you know, who the next superintendent will be.
Well, yes. So I think this race exactly, you know, exemplifies the battle that you're talking about. And this is the battle that's happening in the school board, is those who are in favor of reform and charter and, you know, what they say is more accountability for teachers, and those who are backed by the unions and don't want those reforms and want to stay the course and are in favor of things like teacher tenure. So I think that this will be in many ways kind of a bellwether or a referendum on that. I think the power of the school board does hang in the balance. Obviously, they have a big decision to make in terms of who's going to replace John Dacey. And a lot of the negative independent expenditures were actually about the school board race, were against Bennett Kaiser. And so while the story for the city council races is that the incumbents were winning, it's not necessarily true for the school board. The incumbents are going to face runoffs and didn't necessarily fare as well.
See, it is important and interesting to vote. You made me believe.
The nicest thing anyone will say about me all day.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, vice president also of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
All right, citizens of Los Angeles, did you vote? Why or why not? What would get you to go to the polls if you didn't vote? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can sound off on our Facebook page. That's KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the amazing Randy. He's a magician who uses tricks to reveal the truth about charlatans. We'll find out how he created his stunts next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In the 1970s, the psychic Uri Geller was a fixture on the TV chat shows. And I don't know, maybe you remember him. He was famous for bending spoons with nothing more he said than the power of his mind.
It's cracking. I feel it under my fingers. See how gently it goes? It's like it's becoming like plastic.
It's right.
And it's very...
But when Geller appeared on The Tonight Show in 1973, things didn't go so well.
Jack, we are back. Uri was telling me you don't feel what? Strong tonight?
I don't feel strong. It's not all tonight. Right now I'm feeling being pressed and then I can't.
Well, I'm not trying to press you. I really not.
You're only telling me, well, will you try that or that?
Well, I thought that was the idea of.
Carson had spoiled Geller's act by consulting with a magician named the Amazing Randy. After that, Randy would become Geller's lifelong nemesis and one of the world's most famous skeptics. Now, a new documentary about Randy tells the story of how he used magic to unmask deceivers, from mentalists to televangelists. It's called An Honest Liar.
Some people cannot believe that a magician can fool them in such a way that they can't figure it out. But magicians can, and magicians do. Swindlers do, con men do all the time. They're not magicians. They're fakes. They're lying to us. They're deceiving us.
And the Amazing Randy, James Randy, is here now. Welcome.
Ta-da! I'm here, yes. Thank you so much.
In the flesh. You're not just an illusion. So tell us what you told the producers of Johnny Carson's show when Uri Geller was going to come
on. I was already familiar with Johnny, of course, and I'd been on his program many times. I did some 29 appearances over the years and got to know him very well and how he operated, and I was told Geller's going to be on the show tonight, so come on in to Los Angeles. Since Geller was doing a lot of television appearances at that particular section of his career, I would get my phone ringing at odd hours, and I would pick up the phone, say James Randi, and I'd hear a click, and I'd immediately run to the television, switch it on, and Geller would come up on the next program coming up on a major network. But he was calling to make sure that I wasn't backstage, you see, at the studio. So I said, no, that won't work. He'll be suspicious. So he may back out. So I'll talk to the prop man and tell the prop man how to design a foolproof test of whether or not he can bend spoons with his mind. So the question is, how does he do it? And the answer is very simple, and this is the entire answer. He does it when you're not looking. And that's how he's done it all of his life. When he is presented with a teaspoon, he apparently has to pick it up in both of his hands.
Uh-huh.
Now, that seems strange. Why would he do that? And then he turns away immediately.
And so while he's doing that, he's switching the spoons?
No, he's just simply bending it.
Oh, I see.
Spoon is not difficult to bend, because when he then turns back to face you, he shields most of the spoon with his other hand and then starts to stroke it gently and lets it droop over his hand. The point is, he does it when you're not looking.
So unmasking Uri Geller sent you on your way in terms of unmasking people who were committing these acts of, I don't know, would you call them fraud or
fraud?
Magic?
Oh, yes, fraud. No question of it. Because Geller says constantly, I don't know how to do tricks. I don't know how to bend spoons except with my mind, etc. And that's a fraud.
But what's the difference between that and just what a regular magician does?
The magician doesn't say to you that he has magical powers, that he's in touch with intergalactic forces that enable him to do this with his brain. And that influences a lot of people. If they think that he's got control over powers like that, why then can't he help them with their financial problems or with whatever emotional problem they may be coming up with? I often get the question, what's the harm in this? If people want to believe, The way it should be phrased, I think, is what is the harm in it if people need to believe this? That's okay if they've got a belief in it that doesn't do them any harm. But the kind of thing is when they are subject to the people out there who on television, particularly on television now, of course, because that's the medium that they work most easily on, people like Peter Popoff, the preacher, who claimed that he was in direct touch with heaven and that he could tell people's names and their addresses and whatnot merely by getting this message in his head.
And God told me, he said, you smite that cancer with your fist. You've got cancer of the stomach? Are you ready for God to burn that cancer out? Here it goes in the mighty. Devil, back off. Back off, devil!
So that's a real harm, right?
Oh, yes,
that
it is.
Was
very
perpetrated on,
harm, yes.
On lots and lots of people that they actually believed in the
yes.
curative
and
powers.
And needed to believe in it.
And
yes.
needed to believe in the curative powers. There's another part of in the documentary where two former associates of yours,
yes.
these two young men, you sent them to Stanford.
Was no, Stanford? Not to Stanford Research Institute, actually. No, they did this for a physicist who will remain unnamed. He was a prominent physicist who believed, and to this day still believes, in these psychic powers. And he believes that the two kids had the psychic powers, though they revealed the whole modus operandi to him in detail. By now, you would think he'd be convinced that he was wrong. No, he still believes in the powers of what we call the alpha kids.
So even scientists who yes. purport to live in the world of reason yeah. are easily deceived.
Yes, and they're easily deceived because they think logically, and the magician thinks logically as well, but in the opposite direction. I can fool a scientist in most cases much more easily than I can a 10-year-old child. And the reason is simple. The 10-year-old child is not sophisticated enough to be fooled. In other words, if I take, here, I have a Kleenex tissue in my hand right here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I roll up into a little tiny ball like that. Watch carefully now. And it goes away. A miracle. How did he do that? I have one under my armpit here that looks exactly the same. Now, this is lost on our listeners.
I really didn't see you put
I
that
hope
under
not,
your armpit.
Because this is my profession,
trick.
You see. But the point is, a little sleight of hand thing that I just showed you here. Very, very simple. This is what magicians do. They use misdirection by looking in the direction where they want you to look, you see.
Mm.
Because you think, oh, he must know what's happening. So where he's watching is where the thing actually took place. But it's not.
But by unmasking the scientists, do you then give ammunition to people who are skeptical of some science, let's say, people who don't agree with vaccinations, to say, look, see, they are fallible. And so therefore, does that not give ammunition to people who are maybe not as pro-science?
The point is that I was showing scientists and showing the public that scientists can be fooled if they don't have enough expertise in a certain direction. Because the scientists assume, oh, no, I'm too good an observer. I'm too smart. I'm a PhD. I know about these. No, you don't know about these things. Don't fool yourself. I'm trying to teach the scientists to doubt their own infallibility.
You have been the subject of some backlash, people attacking you.
Oh, yes.
Millions and millions of people upon this planet who have other ways of
I have never said these
sensing.
Things have not happened.
Why don't
I have
you read the papers and correct yourself?
I'll think you say Uri Gill is a fake. No. You came here and you've given
never.
Everybody a lot of lip
never.
Service.
No, no, no.
And you haven't done anything. We're going for a commercial break and you can piss off.
Were you surprised by that?
No, no, not at all. Because remember, many people out there, they want very much for there to be supernatural powers. Because if they reach some situation where medical science says, no, there is nothing we can do for this victim, the child or the adult, whoever it might be, this is a fatal disease. It is terminal, and there's just no hope. We can't give you any hope. These people immediately go to the faith healers. They'll immediately go to the religious people out there who say, oh, no, with heaven, all things are possible. And they'll start to take money and they'll take all the money they can get and they'll get fabulously wealthy on the cupidity, the innocence of these people who tend to believe that because they need to believe it.
So you're not surprised by regular people who see what you've unmasked turning against you rather than the
deceiver. Oh, no, I'm not surprised by that at all. Now, in some of the religious meetings that I've gone to, and I've seen people like Peter Popoff, for example, apparently healing people on the stage. One lady, we got her at a big auditorium, and we saw this lady walking with two canes with great difficulty into the studio to sit down in the audience. And we approached her, and I spoke to her, and I asked her name. And I said, are you going to be healed by Reverend Popoff today? Oh, yes, I've seen him heal people on television. And they walk again, and they can throw away their canes. And I said, will you be disappointed if it doesn't happen? Oh, it will happen. I have great faith. I have great faith. And she walked on. She sat in the audience. She was eventually asked up on stage, and Popoff took her canes and broke one of them and threw the other one away. And she staggered around the cage. She had to be held on her feet. And remember, these tapes are all very carefully edited to edit out such inconsistencies in the healing. And she was guided off stage, very carefully held by the elbows and such. Well, we saw her, and she had two canes back again. From one of the canes that was just thrown away, she replaced the broken one. And she was walking along with the same great difficulty. And we approached her, ma'am, you apparently are not healed, and yet you believe that Peter Popoff healed you? And she said, yes, but I must have lost the faith somewhere along the line. I didn't keep the faith, you see. Mm-hmm. I lost it. And she staggered off on her canes, but then she turned and looked over her shoulder, and she called out to us, but I still believe.
All right. I just want to ask you one more question about magic.
Okay.
And magic tricks. A lot of magicians obviously don't show how it's done.
No, they don't do that. It would be ridiculous that you wouldn't have any delusion. See, a magician is an actor playing the part of a magician. That's what he is.
But and, do you, when you do your magic tricks or perform, do you show how it's done?
Oh, no. No, because the whole thing is down the drain at that point, you see. And no, I don't do that because I'm protecting the profession, of course. The same way an actor on stage playing the part of Hamlet will step forward to take bows at the end of the show and take off the wig. And you would be insulted if that man then said to you, ladies and gentlemen, I must tell you that this is not just an act. I am a prince of Denmark. You would be insulted. And yet you're not insulted by the people who say, the astrologers, for example, oh, we can look at the sky and tell by the relationship of the planets to the fixed stars in the sky, we can tell what the name of your child will be and what the gender will be and on like this. And they take money for that kind of thing. Astrology is just as much nonsense as the faith healing racket.
Was there anything that you were staunchly disbelieving in that then you changed your mind about? Anything that you thought this is just a load of hokum and then you were like, and then you came to believe in it? Anything?
Well, Sophia Loren. You can't look that good without there being some witchcraft going on, so I'm very suspicious of that.
Well, James Randi, aka the Amazing Randi. Thank you for coming in.
A great pleasure.
The Amazing Randi, he's the subject of a new documentary. It's called An Honest Liar, and it opens in theaters this weekend. Yeah, it's tough to see a magic trick on the radio, and so that's why we videotaped the Amazing Randi doing a trick when he was here in the studio, so you can see it. You can actually see it on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. And we would like to know what you think. Are there some things you still believe despite what reason tells you, like astrology? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Again, that's KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how one food item got itself a powerful lobby in Washington and what that means for what kids eat. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs, continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 5 years ago, a powerful group formed to influence American politics. Not a presidential campaign or a super PAC, but the American Pizza Community. That's a lobby group on behalf of, yep, pizza. Of the nearly 12,000 registered lobbyist groups in Washington, only one represents a specific dish. There is, for example, no enchilada or double cheeseburger lobby, but the pizza lobby has spent millions to influence policymakers. Andrew Martin is a reporter for Bloomberg News, and he joins me now to explain the unique origin story of the American pizza
Madeline.
Community. Why is it called that? Is it really a community of pizza?
Well, I mean, the idea is that it's a coalition of competitors that have sort of banded together to, on behalf of pizza, all things pizza.
All things pizza.
So they're a community of pizza lovers and sellers, I should add.
So these are your Domino's, your Little Caesars.
Domino's, Little Caesars, Papa John's. There's a bunch of kind of regional chains. Figaro's is one on the West Coast, I know. And it's most of the big ones a fair number of regional ones.
So it seems that pizza is the only dish or prepared food really with its own specific lobbying group.
Well, I spent an inordinate amount of time trying to nail that down. It sort of depends how you define it. There is a candy lobby. Yeah. There is a yogurt lobby. A lot of commodities have different lobbies. So there's a beef lobby. There's a potato lobby. But the distinction here is this is a prepared food, a dish that the only one that I could find, at least, that has its own lobby. As you pointed out, you know, they're competitors, tacos, burritos, cheeseburgers, fried chicken, hot dogs, don't have their own lobby. It's just pizza.
Okay, so they've gotten together to form this lobbying group. What do they want?
Well, there's kind of two pizza lobbies in one who both want different things. There's a frozen pizza lobby and a fresh pizza lobby. So the fresh pizza lobby is upset about a new law that requires menu labeling at restaurants. So when you go into, in New York now, when you go into a Starbucks or McDonald's, there's menu labeling that tells you how many calories are in each standard menu item. That's become a national law. It takes effect in December. And the fresh pizza people hate it because they say a couple things. One, they say, for businesses that are primarily delivery, it's silly because no one will see it and it's an expense they don't want to spend. Two, they say, Domino's makes this point that, there's 34 million potential toppings. I'm bad at math, so I couldn't fact check that point. But that it would be impossible to sort of come up with all the various calorie combinations. And thirdly, at least initially, the proposed law said that that they would have to label the calories on a full pie, not just a slice. And they claimed that was unfair and that, if somebody came in and saw that the, bacon cheeseburger, large pizza at Pizza Hut was, 4,000 calories, they wouldn't buy it. So they were opposed to all those things and have been fighting them with some success.
And what about frozen? What do they want?
So the frozen people have a different issue, and that is in 2010, Congress passed a law to make school lunches healthier, and maybe not surprising, one of the favorite foods in school lunch is pizza. And the new nutrition requirements had this sort of obscure clause in it about how tomato paste would be counted towards a vegetable serving. And in the past, tomato paste had been counted extra to the point where
been given extra credit, essentially, so that 2 tablespoons of tomato paste counted as a half serving of vegetables. In other words, a vegetable serving. So that's the amount that went on a slice of pizza. So in essence, pizza counted as a vegetable. And the proposed law would have changed that and said 2 tablespoons of tomato paste is 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, meaning that pizza wouldn't be a vegetable. So the frozen pizza people went berserk and fought against this successfully.
Wow.
And was able to stop that. They also pushed, along with some other food groups, to slow implementation of new nutrition standards that would reduce the amount of sodium that's allowed and increase the amount of whole foods or whole grains. They're successful on all fronts.
Yeah, so meanwhile, they do have some very real enemies. People who don't think that pizza is a healthy food that shouldn't be in school lunches, for example, who don't think tomato paste should be counted as a vegetable serving, and people who are in favor of more food lobbying, and just people in general who think that, well, Americans should eat healthier foods that, involve fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, I think the argument from some of the people, the nutrition advocates that sort of pushed these rules to begin with, and, you know, people like Michelle Obama, who's been very outspoken on this, and Tom Colicchio, the top chef judge, has spoken out on this, is that, you know, it's not that they don't like pizza, that pizza can't be an occasional serving at school lunch, but they serve too much of it, and that if the government is paying for this food, they should make sure these kids get proper nutrition. And if they're going to serve pizza, at the very least, they should serve healthier pizza, not the stuff we're used to, which is, you know, gobs of cheese and lots of salt. Mm-hmm. That's why it's delicious.
It's delicious, but let's be real. Okay, it's not the healthiest of foods. Donuts are delicious as well.
Exactly.
So has all this lobbying paid off? Have they seen success?
It has paid off. The frozen pizza people really had amazing success in that they were able to kill this tomato paste brouhaha proposal outright. It's dead. It's not happening. So pizza still counts as a vegetable serving in school lunch. And they've had some success, as I said, delaying rules that would require less sodium and more whole grains, which obviously affects pizza as well. So they've basically batted 1,000. There is some talk now that some of the school lunch nutrition requirements, now that Republicans control Congress, that they'll continue to sort of scale back on some of those. There's a feeling that there's sort of nanny state regulations and the government shouldn't tell kids what to eat. So that could even go further than what they've already had. On the fresh pizza side, they're successful in getting the FDA to change this requirement that they label pizzas, the calories on a whole pizza. Now they get to label it by the slice.
So how many calories on a slice?
Well, it all depends on your toppings.
Oh, no. Let's just say a cheese slice.
I would say anywhere from 300 to 500 calories.
Wow.
If you get the meat lovers special, it's up on that higher end. But a standard slice of pepperoni pizza something tends to be about 300 calories.
All right. Delicious news. Thank you. Andrew Martin, reporter for Bloomberg News. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Hi, Warren. Are you a pizza lover?
I'm not really
a pizza fighter.
I eat pizza occasionally.
It is delicious.
Not that often.
All right. So that lobbying is lost on you.
What about you?
I love it.
You do?
I do. I don't eat it that often, but, you know.
It depends.
Anyway, on to more meatier subjects.
Whoa. Well, we'll be meaty about the U.S. Supreme Court today. And the question arises, what if the Republicans win, essentially, and the court throws out 7 million people's health insurance? One of our guests, I think, is going to say that it'll be like the dog that caught the car. Because the Republicans might not want to be blamed for the fact that all those people will lose their insurance. That's just one of the issues we'll take up as we look at the arguments in the case and the political consequences that might result. And it may well be that the people on the court who are in fact in favor of the Affordable Care Act were among those who voted to take this case because they just want to get rid of it.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. So look forward to that. And the arguments, as we talked about earlier on the show, happened this morning. 1 o'clock for To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And, well, it is lunchtime, so we're going to stick with food. L.A., no stranger to food fads. We have a new one to tell you about next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the latest big food trend is here, just in time for the end of flu season. Broth. Bone broth, to be specific, and the bone broth evangelists range from Kobe Bryant to LA chef Mark Peel. Peel's new bone broth stand in Grand Central Market is set to open soon. Catherine Spires is here now to explore the bone broth craze with us, and she is food editor at KCET. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Bone broth.
Yes.
What is it?
Well, it's funny. There's actually another word for bone broth. It's broth, or you could even call it stock if you wanted to. That's
There's
literally
no
all
difference?
This. No, there really isn't. The ingredients in bone broth, much like in broth or stock, are the bones of animals, maybe some vegetables and some seasonings. You simmer it for at least 12 hours, and there you go.
Bone broth.
There it is.
Stock.
Yes.
So it's not the bouillon cube. It's a little bit more advanced than that.
It's definitely a lot more than that. You have to actually get the bones of an animal for it to be a meat bone broth. And it certainly tastes good and there's nothing wrong with it, but it has really blown up for some mysterious reason. It is the hottest food trend going right now.
And where did that start?
I think it started in New York City. As most things do.
Yeah.
There's a dedicated broth restaurant. It's really more of a stall, but it's called Brodo, and all they serve is various broths. But it's made the jump over to Los Angeles, and it's gangbusters here. There's even a cocktail at a bar called Pistola that's made with scotch and beef broth.
Oh, have you tried it?
I haven't. I don't need to.
So you're kind of drinking your meal and drinking your drink at the same time with that, I guess.
Yeah, sure. It's more efficient.
So, okay, so then the trainer for the Lakers is also getting in on this?
Yeah, the trainer for the Lakers has the whole team on bone broth supplements. And
wait, supplements?
Well, I'm, you know, supplementing their actual diet, yes.
I mean, but that would be next, right?
Right, of course it'll be next. And so the player who's talked about it the most is Kobe Bryant, and that's partly because he's a star and he's really feeling the effects of getting older right now. And what a lot of people say about bone broth is that it'll help your collagen, and collagen is where your joints are affected. A lot of people want it for the health benefits. They may be overstating the health benefits a little bit.
Is there any scientific backing for bone broth's health benefits at all?
There really isn't much scientific backing for bone broth benefits. There are a couple of things. For instance, it's certainly not bad for you. And if the act of consuming collagen actually gave us more collagen in our joints and our hair and our skin, then yeah, it would be great for that, but it's not that simple. There have been some studies done specifically about chicken bone broth. And there's some idea that that can help with respiratory infections. I think that if it's a store-bought broth, then that actually might be the salt content, because salt is an anti-inflammatory as well. But there's no reason not to consume broth if you're not feeling well.
Right. And just the hot liquid that makes you feel better.
Absolutely.
Makes your chest feel better.
Yeah, it's really basic. People are really going overboard with it, but it's, you know, it's a simple dish.
And it has some protein in it, maybe?
There is some protein, but the things like amino acids that the adherents of the bone broth diet are really gung-ho for, you can actually get better amino acids, et cetera, from leafy green vegetables. And no one ever wants to hear that. But again, it's leafy greens that have the most nutrients in them.
But it does sort of, it is sort of, in, is it in reaction to the whole vegan thing or not?
I actually think it's more of a paleo diet thing than a reaction against anything else. But the paleo diet tends to go a little overboard. They tend to get a little overly excited about what they espouse as healthy. And I think that this is an example of that.
Okay, so why is Mark Peel getting in on this and actually opening up a restaurant or a stall, what have you, devoted to this?
Why not, right? It's a smart business decision at the moment. And he's not doing just the plain broth. He will be having pastas and meats and stuff like that. It's just going to be, it'll be boiled or braised in the broth. So he's taking a very trendy concept and he's going with it, but making a little bit more involved. I think it'll last longer than the trend does.
What'll be the next one, do you think?
Oh, the next trend, probably.
We should start one right now.
I know. Let's name it. I think it's going to be intestines.
Whisker broth.
That's a good idea.
All right. So there's Mark Peel's place. You mentioned the cocktail. Where else can we get bone broth if we have to have it?
If you have to have bone broth, a lot of the trendier butcher shops in town, like Bel Campo, which has a couple of locations, they're offering it. And you can either get a fully ready-to-go hot 8-ounce coffee cup full of bone broth. That'll set you back $3.50. Or if you want to take it home, you can get a frozen quart of it for $10. And they have told me that every day that they offer it, they sell out completely. In fact, I called them today at about 11:30 and they'd already sold out of today's bone broth.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Or if you are looking into a CSA, a grocery delivery program, there's actually quite a few in town that are offering bone broth right now. And again, just the sales are through the roof for this.
Or you could just make it yourself.
You could.
You could just get some bones and some water.
You really could.
Have you tasted it?
You know, I've had broth in my life.
But not this broth.
It's true. I haven't had Bel Campo's. I haven't had it delivered to my house. I haven't had any sort of fancy bone broth.
Maybe that makes it taste better.
Sure. If you've paid $3.50 for some broth, you're going to enjoy the heck out of it, right?
Well, Catherine Spires, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Spires is food editor at KCET. I would have broth right this minute if I could. I'm a little hungry. Julie Myers?
I would freebase some broth right now. Okay, idea on how to get people out to vote.
Yes.
Serve bone broth.
There we go. Ding, ding, ding.
We wanted your ideas on how to get people to the polls. Lorenzo says that we should make voting day a holiday. Give people the day off. Tell them why and people will vote. Similarly, Chris Resurrection suggests that we move voting day from a Tuesday to the weekend. He says, hello, most people work on Tuesdays. Jess Alexander says the trick is to ask people if they think the dress is gold and white or black and blue. Easy. People will come out and weigh in on that. And Terrence Brown, with perhaps the most ingenious suggestion, serve beer. Come on. Make it a party. Or pizza. I think that the pizza lobby could probably get on board there.
Maybe have a pet llama there to pet. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Turn them loose.
Yeah.
Put them in that blue and black dress and turn them loose. Everybody will show up.
All right, Julie Myers, fantastic ideas. Keep them coming. Twitter at KCRW Press Play, Facebook KCRW Press Play, Warren Olney. And To the Point, next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.